I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Confirmation of the second Ebola case in Texas has increased anxiety about the spread of the virus across the country. David Willman, who's been covering the outbreak for the Los Angeles Times, joins us with an update. But for most of the hour, a conversation about money and politics with Congressman John Sarbanes of Maryland's 3rd District. In the wake of the Supreme Court decisions that opened the door for more big money in campaigns, John Sarbanes has been working to get small money back in the game. We'll hear his ideas about establishing networks of everyday donors to counter the effects of big money from corporations and super PACs. That's next on Midday. First, the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks with you every Monday through Friday, noon to 2 on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Hagerstown in Frederick, WYPO Ocean City in the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and streaming live online via WYPR.org. We thank you again for making Midday part of your day. According to Representative John Sarbanes, the Supreme Court's rulings on Citizens United and McCutcheon in the McCutcheon case have shaken the very foundation of our democracy by allowing big money, backed by special interests, to influence, others might say corrupt, our political process. To counter that trend, he's backing legislation that would establish a new system to diminish the hold that big money has on American politics. He'll join us for most of this hour today to talk about that effort to get so-called small money back into political campaigns. I want to welcome John Sarbanes to our show. Nice to have you back, Congressman.
Thanks, Dan. It's great to be here.
We're going to talk about that for most of the hour, as I said, but up front we wanted to get an update on the Ebola epidemic because of the news over the weekend. A Dallas nurse became the first person to contract the virus on American soil, stoking fears about the spread of Ebola here. Congressman, we're going to spend a minute with David Willman. David Willman is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Los Angeles Times who's been part of a team covering the Ebola epidemic for the LA Times. David Willman, welcome back to Midday. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Dan. Good to be here.
Where are we as of this hour, David? Anything new? I keep checking the news reports on Ebola. I just wondered in the last couple of hours, anything new from Texas?
Not that I know of. Of course, we do have a nurse in Dallas who has tested preliminarily positive for the Ebola virus. She had been among those who had cared for Thomas Edward Duncan, the Liberian who had traveled to Dallas by air a couple weeks ago and died last Wednesday. There was a potential case that emerged over the weekend in Boston. We all are waiting to see if that individual tests positive or not for Ebola. So that's where we are as of Friday. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention was saying that there had been 4,033 counted deaths from this current epidemic of Ebola in West Africa, which is the worst ever outbreak of this disease in recorded history.
The director of the CDC said over the weekend that there had been a breach of protocol causing the nurse to contract the disease. Do we know anything more about that? Have they been any more specific about what the breach was?
To my knowledge, they have not, and there's, I think, a lot more to be learned about that. I saw one of the federal officials question just a little bit yesterday on CNN about the assertion that this infection of the nurse is attributable to a breach in protocol, and the answer that was given was that, well, the policy-setting federal officials have total confidence in the protocol, therefore, if the nurse got infected, she must have somehow violated the protocol. But there's been no specific evidence or basis put out there to support that, may be, may not be. But it could raise questions on two fronts. One is the difficulty with which it is actually to follow these very demanding protocols with really zero margin of error. And secondly, and some of our coverage in the Los Angeles Times has been getting at, how can we be absolutely confident in assumptions that we know exactly how the disease is transmitted?
And David Willman from the LA Times, over the weekend he had an interesting story, interesting to me to say the least, kind of a scary story. But let's talk about it and tell our listeners what you discovered about Ebola from a study sponsored by the World Health Organization and published last month in the New England Journal of Medicine. This concerns the major symptom, the one symptom that above all others is supposed to signal danger with Ebola, and that is fever. But this study indicates that it isn't necessarily an absolute in all cases.
Well, that's right. Our account yesterday, published on the front page of the Los Angeles Times, was really derived from the most current New England Journal of Medicine published study, which was that research was sponsored by the World Health Organization. It is the largest epidemiological study of the West Africa outbreak. That study looked at 3,343 confirmed and 667 additional probable cases of Ebola, and found that in 87.1 of those cases that the infected patient had exhibited fever, and that 12.9% did not exhibit fever. Now, it turns out that is consistent with other research that's been done in the past. We cited in yesterday's article research of a previous outbreak in Uganda, which found a varying percentage of 85 to 88% of those who were documented had fever. And there was another study that was referred to as well. And I interviewed at length a physician who had to evacuate and shut down his hospital in Sierra Leone. And he described in explicit detail the case of a patient who's had been checked four times a day over a period of 3 days for fever, never exhibited fever, and died. So this raises questions about absolute confidence that if you just check people for fever as they're boarding an airplane, well, as long as they don't have fever, then they can't be shedding virus. And so the questions are raised, and in fact, Paul Stolle, a highly respected physician and epidemiologist, former chief of the epidemiology branch, if you will, at the University of Maryland, former disease investigator for the Centers for Disease Control, and a member of the Institute of Medicine, concluded that, that this, quote, requires further investigation, and we quoted Dr. Stolle as saying that.
And the advisories, though, I guess the but here is that the advisories we've been getting from CDC and from NIH is that if fever is the main indicator.
Well, that is true. I mean, it is a leading indicator by the best available research. In other words, the New England Journal WHO study just published said that 87.1% had fever. The difficulty here is, we are basing, and Dr. Frieden, the head of the CDC, and others have made very absolute statements saying, as long as the prospective passenger getting on an airplane from Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea coming toward the United States, entering the United States, does not have fever before boarding that airplane or as they're exiting an airplane, then there's no grounds for suspicion unless they're showing other visible signs of disease.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, within 13%, or if you want to say within 5%, 13%, you know, you have a real risk that's being run here. And the same is true, by the way, when people present at hospitals for care. And this has paralyzed healthcare already in Sierra Leone and Liberia. And you can imagine the pressures that would be put on U.S. hospitals if we can't trust fever as being the, you know, sentinel sign.
Just remind me, if you can, David, Thomas Eric Duncan, a Liberian who arrived in this country in September and ended up in the hospital in Dallas and then died last week, did he have a fever when he showed up at the hospital?
Yes, he did have fever when he showed up at the hospital in Dallas, but let's rewind that tape just a little bit more. He was recorded as not having fever at the airport near Monrovia, Liberia, when he left there. And as we know, Mr. Duncan flew from Liberia to Brussels, transferred to Dulles International Airport near Washington, D.C., and then made his way to Dallas, Texas. A two-day journey, he arrived in Dallas, I believe, on September 20th. He, a few days later, went to the emergency room at Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas and did have fever, but was sent home. One other point of nuance regarding fever, the threshold for checking fever, in other words, you can get on an airplane as long as your fever does not exceed 101.5 degrees. 101.5 degrees. That's a very strong fever, obviously. So under that, you don't trip the wire. Now, as we pointed out in an article about a week ago, and others are now obviously talking about this, and I quoted people in country who said they thought that it would be entirely plausible that if people, even if they suspected that they might be exposed to Ebola before traveling, they're going to take whatever analgesic they need to beat the test.
David Woolman from the LA Times, thanks for your time today. We'll pick this up again tomorrow. We're going to devote a whole hour of midday on Tuesday to Ebola and the outbreak. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan.
All right, David. Talk to you tomorrow. Congressman Sarbanes, John Sarbanes, is with us in the studio here. First of all, I haven't had a chance to talk to you about Ebola. I mean, what is your take on what's happened so far? What is your concern as a congressman?
Obviously, it's a serious situation, particularly when you look at what's happening in West Africa and Sierra Leone and Liberia and Guinea, where this has reached, you know, epidemic proportions. And, you know, the world has to have a response that can contain that and eventually reduce and eliminate the threat. In terms of what's happening here in this country, it's natural for people to be anxious and fearful when something like this happens. What we want to make sure is that fear doesn't turn into panic. I mean, fear can be healthy if it's applied in a sort of focused way because it wakes people up, it makes them alert. But we don't want to have panic. And frankly, I'm going to rely, and I think many members of Congress will rely, and they should, on experts in this area, on healthcare professionals, on the science. We're having a hearing this coming Thursday, the Energy and Commerce Committee. Thomas Frieden from the Centers for Disease Control will be there, and possibly Anthony Fauci, who runs the Division for Infectious Disease at NIH, will be there to discuss the situation. Having said all that, I think that while we need to be concerned, the likelihood of a severe outbreak of Ebola in the United States is extremely, extremely low if you listen to what the professionals are telling us. And so we just got to make sure that we proceed in a cautious way, that we abide by the protocols that the healthcare professionals put forward. There seems to have been a lapse in that in this Dallas situation. They're trying to pinpoint where it happened. It doesn't mean the protocols are off, from what I understand. It just means they can be difficult to adhere to, as the last caller just indicated. So we're going to pay careful attention to this, and we have to understand that people are rightly anxious about it.
I just wonder, have you heard from constituents about this? I've received emails at The Sun and some here from listeners suggesting that all flights from those countries in West Africa most affected to the United States just be stopped.
I've heard about that, and, you know, we are getting some constituent mail on the issue generally. I think we have to be careful about that because, you know, there's some evidence that when you increase the isolation, in this case of West Africa, it makes it harder to actually address the situation there and improve on the situation. And so I think, you know, we have to have protocols in place. We have to have diagnostic tests that maybe go beyond just calculating what somebody's fever is. I mean, that's a fair point. And those tests are being looked at, I know, by NIH and CDC so that you can screen people appropriately as they're leaving West Africa and as they're coming into the United States. So all those things need to be in place, and I think that they will be.
Congressman John Sarbanes is our guest in this hour of midday. We'll take our first break here. When we come back, we'll change the subject. I'm going to talk to John Sarbanes about his legislation, his efforts to get small money back into politics, make democracy more democratic. We'll hear about that when we get back. A short break on midday. And welcome back to Midday. As I mentioned, we'll be devoting an hour of our show tomorrow to Ebola. That'll be in the noon hour of Tuesday. Dan Roderick's here. Ever since the Supreme Court's Citizen United decision 4 years ago, and then last year we had the McCutcheon case before the Supreme Court, a lot of talk, a lot of concern about the role special interests play in our politics and how super PACs and undisclosed donors are pouring endless amounts of money into campaigns. Some would even argue that this money is hijacking the democratic process. John Sarbanes is with us, the congressman from Maryland's 3rd District. He's been lobbying for the passage of the Government by the People Act, which he's here to talk about. John, nice to see you again. You know, the first time we talked about this on my show was 2011 or 2012 when you first had this idea. And then, but you actually set up a model for mm-hmm. doing this. Right. And so I thought it'd be helpful for our listeners just to explain your basic concept and how that first road test went in 2012.
So in 2012, Dan, the idea was how do we begin turning our attention more towards everyday citizens, small donors, as a source of funding for campaigns? And I wanted to force myself to do that. So I went to higher donors and I said, I want you to raise a challenge fund for me and I'll agree to put it off limits and I won't touch it. I won't unlock it until I can go recruit 1,000 new first-time small donors. That's people who give $100 or less.
$100 or less.
Yeah.
Starting at $5?
Starting at $5.
Okay.
So that was a real powerful incentive to me, because in order to access these funds that we'd sort of reserved, I had to go get a fat. We did it. By June 30th of 2012, we hit our goal. This time around, under the banner of the My Voice campaign, because it's designed to empower everyday citizens to say, my voice does count, because so many of them feel like their voice doesn't count anymore. We selected 100 neighborhoods across the 3rd District, and in each place we're trying to build this sort of small donor matching structure where we go recruit the $5 and $10 donor in order to unlock some matching funds. What I'm doing with this experiment is I'm road testing what candidates all across America would have the incentive to do if there was a small donor matching system, a public funded small donor matching system, which is they'd want to go find those small donors, because if you find the $10 donor or the $50 donor, you earn a match of public dollars.
If you reach the goal, right?
Under my system that I proposed in H.R. 20, the Government by the People Act, you get a 6-to-1 match of public funds for every small donation that comes in up to $150. So, for example, somebody donates $50 to your campaign, you get another $300 in matching funds. That's real money. That means you have an incentive to go find the $50 donor instead of spending all your time chasing the PACs and the $1,000 donor. That's the solution.
A question about the first test of this in 2012. So you had some money. You had a safe seat in Congress. You put some money aside.
Right.
How much money did you have in your campaign that year?
I think all told, we raised about $900,000 that year.
Before you went around asking for $5 and $10 from people, how much did you had a sizable amount of money?
Yeah, okay. Probably half that amount.
Okay, so the idea was you wouldn't touch your treasury until you reached how much?
1,000 small donations,
of any size.
Any size,
100
or less. Exactly, okay. And we hit that goal. And what it did was it made us learn what are those techniques for reaching the small donor.
I'm curious, what are those techniques?
Well,
because,
obviously,
you know, for years people have said, well, they don't need us. You don't need my $5. You don't need my $10 because you got some lobbyist or some super PAC that's going to take care of you.
And that's the way most people feel these days.
Yeah.
But what you do is, first of all, there's a lot of new online tools that you can reach people with. But you also got to get back to pressing the flesh, going and doing the house parties, having those small gatherings, actually knocking on doors. This time, Dan, I was up in Parkville a few months ago, literally knocking on doors, asking people if they'd step up and be a $5 donor to help us model.
What was that like? And what kind of reaction did you get from people?
Well, actually, I got a very positive reaction, because they were like, there's a member of Congress who's bothering to come to my door and ask me to invest in their campaign. But I was able to say, look, under the system I'm proposing, even a small donation like that can make a difference. It can matter. It can make your voice be heard.
So part of your pitch to people is that you're trying to change the system. So when they're making a donation to you, it's not so much just John Sarbanes, who they recognize, a Democrat in a majority Democratic district, you're probably going to be all right. But they're actually supporting your cause.
It's a model. Idea. It's an experiment. It's a model to show how this would work. And let's go back to the origins of why this makes sense. If you stand in front of any group these days, according to the polls, 96% of them who are sitting out there think that big money is a problem in our politics, in our government. And they're fed up. They're disgusted. They think that Washington has basically been taken captive by big money and special interests, and that everyday people can't get a word in edgewise. And having been there for 8 years and seeing it from the inside, that perspective is not totally off the mark. Big money has a tremendous amount of influence on the way policy gets made in Washington. And if in order to raise money for your campaign, and those are big dollars that you have to raise typically across the country in all these districts, if you have to go to the PACs and the big money donors, then it's only human nature that when it comes time to vote on policy, you're going to lean in that direction. It's not even necessarily a conscious thing. It's just human nature. So the question is, how do we shift the dependency that Congress currently has on big money, shift it away, and make government, as James Madison said, dependent upon the people alone? And the way you do that is you create a small donor matching system so that it pays candidates, it rewards candidates to go find the small donors instead of having to chase the PACs and the big money all the time. That's the essence of the kind of reform that the Government by the People Act would put in place.
Someone listening to that, John, may say, well, that's good, that sounds good, but why don't you just reverse Citizens United? Why don't you reverse McCutcheon, the Supreme Court decisions?
There's two basic ways to address this big money influence we have. One is what I call the containment model. That's putting limits on big money. And that's what Citizens United was all about, McCutcheon and so forth. And the fact of the matter is we're losing that battle right now in this Supreme Court. The only remedy that's out there, given the court's makeup, is a constitutional amendment to allow us to regulate big money. And I support that. The problem with it is that's very, very difficult to achieve. So if the containment model right now isn't working, we need to pursue something else. And I call that the empowerment model. That's the idea that, okay, maybe we can't limit the amount of big money out there, but we can start competing with it on behalf of everyday citizens to get the attention. I mean, it's sort of like, let's create a shiny object for candidates to see out of their corner of their eye, and that's a public matching system for small donations. Then all of a sudden, that $25 donor becomes not just relevant, but the most important person in your campaign. And I believe that this change can happen. And we've seen a tremendous amount of advocacy developing behind this. We now have almost 160 co-sponsors in the House for the Government by the People Act. We have 500,000 people across the country who have signed petitions in support of H.R. 20, this reform. We have a national coalition, Dan, that includes not just traditional good government and reform groups that you'd expect to see in this space, Common Cause, Public Campaign, Public Citizen, but environmental groups like Greenpeace, the Sierra Club, League of Conservation Voters, Friends of the Earth, civil rights groups like the NAACP, labor groups like ASME and SEIU and CWA. Why are they coming to this issue of money in politics? Because they've figured out all the things they want to see, like cleaning up the environment, are not happening in Washington because the influence of big money. So they're saying, in addition to the issue we care about and has been part of our traditional agenda, we have to embrace fighting big money in politics as our own priority.
410-662-8780 is the phone number here on Midday. Dan Rodericks with Congressman John Sarbanes. You heard his idea. What do you think of it? Please give us a ring. Would you go back to giving small donations to politicians, the public officials, or new candidates that you support, as John has described? Would you consider a $5 or $10 donation to someone you think should be in Congress or should be the President of the United States or in the U.S. Senate? 410-662-8780 is our number, the Midday email address. For comments, via email midday@wypr.org. I have two more questions, and then we're going to go to the phone lines. I assume, first of all, that you don't think full public financing of campaigns, presidential, Senate, or the House, is possible either.
Well, this is a hybrid system,
This
right?
is hybrid, I understand. So, but the idea that some people have talked about over the years is just stop. You can't stop private money anymore, given Supreme Court rulings, right? Full public financing, we can't make that more attractive to candidates than it is?
Well, when it comes to the presidential system, we could invest more in it. I mean, the problem there is there's not enough public money in there for presidential candidates to opt for it. I'd like to see more money be in it so that we could get candidates to focus on public funding instead of chasing the private dollars. You know, Ronald Reagan ran his general election using public funding. He didn't hold one fundraiser in the general election. He went out and talked to people. People forget that.
So this is hybrid in that you would have a fund. In order to do the 6-to-1 match, you have to have Congress allocate money for this.
Correct.
Just that there would be a payoff for hitting small donors.
And the small donor is the private investor in a sense, right? But the way the matching system works, in order to access the public funds, you have to go convince a voter, a citizen, to invest in your campaign. So it's not like you just get automatically a grant.
My other question was this. Since you pulled this off in 2012, you're doing it again this year. Have you convinced any of your colleagues from the House of Representatives, any Democrats with competitive seats or even non-competitive seats, to give this a try? Has anyone else tried it?
Two things have happened. We do have candidates, members of Congress across the country that are sort of experimenting with this idea of small donor outreach. Some of them are doing it because they happen to be in very competitive kind of marquee races, so there's this viral thing that kicks in and it works that way. Others are building sort of an infrastructure where they try it. A colleague of mine, Beto O'Rourke, down in Texas, he represents...
What's the name again?
Beto O'Rourke.
Beto O'Rourke.
He represents the El Paso area. He just did, the other day, I think 3 days ago, he did a small donor outreach to see if he could hit certain goals. And it's a... So that's an important experiment that's happening. But the other thing that's happening, Dan, is you're seeing candidates and members of Congress beginning to work into their stump speech, into their narrative, into their messaging to the voters, this idea that reform of the system to lift up everyday citizens and small donors is critical. And they're getting traction with that. When I stand in front of an audience, if I don't start with this issue of how they feel about being left out by the big money influence, a lot of them won't even hear you. It's almost like doing the sound check on the microphone. You have to start with this issue of big money's influence on politics. And then people say, well, maybe this guy knows how I feel. Maybe he's got some ideas on how to fix the system. And then you can go from there. But you got to put it in front of people and be honest with them.
410-662-8780 is our number for a live talk here on Midday. And Congressman Sarbanes, we'll go to Janice in Baltimore and start with you. Thanks for calling, Janice.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Congressman Sarbanes, my question to you is, how are small donors going to hold elected officials accountable? Because what I see happening, I mean, I gave like maybe about $500 to Barack Obama's first presidential campaign. And they send you thank yous and stuff like that. But they're always sending, you know, this barrage of we want money, we need money. But I can't call President Obama. But if Jay-Z or Beyonce want to talk to him, I bet you they can get through.
Mm-hmm.
Or somebody else who has a whole bunch of money. And I always feel like, you know, yeah, you come looking for me when you want money. But any other time when I really want to have something to say, I have no forum. So what kind of forum are people that donate $5, $10, $40, $50, and $60 or $100 going to have? Are you going to have a meeting with them once a year where you get all these people together in a room and they can voice their opinion about what they want to do? Are you going to get some type of a committee that represents, you know, the views of small donors? Because otherwise, I don't see what the point is, really.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Janice.
That's a great question.
I mean, Janice doesn't golf with President Obama. The CEO of Comcast does.
Right.
You know?
That's a great question. And Janice is expressing her slice of the cynicism out there that we encounter every single day. One of the great things about doing small donor outreach is you're reaching out to the same people who can knock on doors, who can stuff envelopes, who can, you know, do all the old-fashioned organizational stuff. And so the more you appeal to those kinds of people to invest in your campaign monetarily, the more you're inviting them to build this kind of old-fashioned grassroots infrastructure that will be there to put pressure on you, frankly. That's what I like about this, because you begin to assemble broad numbers of people who feel more invested, not just in making a small donation, but then they'll go out to the polls because they'll be more invested in the candidate. And they'll begin to organize themselves into a kind of advocacy universe that can really put pressure on the candidate. It's a different kind of pressure. It's not like the phone call coming from the PAC or the high donor into you. It's somebody saying, you know what, we've got 300 people in this precinct in your district who got organized behind you, and they want to see you go do the right thing on issues affecting working families, on the environment, etc. That's a different kind of pressure. To me, it's a kind of pressure that we ought to have. I'd much rather have that conversation and that interaction than the one that is so dominant in Washington, which is the big money crowd calling you and wanting to get things done.
Okay. Now, say someone wanted to unseat you. A big company doesn't like some of your votes in Congress or whatever, and they form a super PAC,
yeah,
maybe with another company, and they dump a whole lot of money into the district close to the election, say, I don't know, 6 weeks out, 5 weeks out, in favor of your opponent, whoever, your theoretical opponent.
Yeah.
It's hard to see Congress agreeing to this system when that panic might set in. That's the fear probably everybody lives with at post-Citizens United, right?
Yep, great question.
Yeah.
So we thought about that. And I want to mention two other pieces of my bill because I didn't get to them. There is the matching component, the Freedom from Influence Matching Fund, we call it. The first piece is we do offer a small tax credit or fundable tax credit to everyday citizens out there who contribute to congressional campaigns. This makes it easier for the small donor to step up and participate, because we're saying, look, if we're going to build a system that's dependent on the small donor, particularly in a world where the Supreme Court has said money is speech, how do people of modest means have speech? Well, we're going to help them with that with the tax credit, get them into the game. So we have the small donor tax credit. We call that the My Voice tax credit. Then we have the Freedom from Influence matching fund to come and boost their voice up. The third piece is we wanted to take account of what could happen in the final stages. So we have a provision that a candidate who participates in the public funding system that we would set up, and by the way, to do that, they have to give up traditional PAC money, they have to limit the amount of high donations that come in, et cetera, so they got to meet certain thresholds. But if they qualify and they get into the home stretch, the last 60 days of the election, and there's some threat coming at them, we've provided for them to be able to access an additional $500,000 of public funding to assist them in those final stages. And so that's one
if
thing.
If they played by all the other rules.
If they play by all the other rules. So that's one thing we've done. The second thing is, think of this. If you go build a small donor network, you have some place to turn in those last 60 days. In 2010, a lot of my colleagues who got targeted by outside money, they didn't have any kind of small donor infrastructure in place. And so when those guys came after them, they had nowhere to turn. They couldn't go back to their high donors because those people were maxed out. They weren't necessarily on the party's list of people to help. They were dead.
And a lot of them lost as a result of that.
Mm. If you have a small donor network in place, then when that super PAC comes after you, think of it like super PAC insurance. You can go to them and say, you know what, they're coming after me. Can you send another $10? Can you send another $25? If you've built a group of 2,500, 5,000 small donors, that's real money. And here's the final thing. The evidence suggests when you look at results of campaigns, you don't have to match the outside money one-to-one. You just need enough money to keep your voice in the mix up to election day. If you're a good candidate and you've served your constituents well and you've built this small donor network, if you can just keep your voice in there until election day, you can still prevail. And there are cases where candidates targeted by outside money were being outspent 3-4 to 1, but they had enough to continue to keep their voice out there, and they ended up beating those super PACs. So there is a way, even in the post-Citizens United world, that good candidates can prevail.
Well, you heard Congressman Sarbanes explain his bill. What do you think of it, the Government by the People Act? Would you go back to giving small donations to candidates that you support under this system if they could get a payoff by accruing a number of small donors from people? What do you think about this? 410-662-8780 is our number here for Midday. All right, we're back on Midday. We'll take Richard's call. Richard in Pikesville, you're on the air with Congressman Sarbanes. Yeah, good. Go right ahead, Richard.
How are you?
Good.
I was curious about something called bundling. Bundling, as I'm sure you know, is when someone gets together with a whole bunch of other people and bundles contributions as one. But what happens if someone gets a bunch of small people, sets up a system where they can get a whole bunch of small people together, but actually letting the candidate know that it's coming from company ABC or whatever? How does your bill or whatever deal with that?
Thank you, Richard.
So that's a good question as well. I mean, first of all, there are rules in place to make sure that the donations that come to you are originating with someone who really wants to make that donation. But in terms of bundling itself, right now you have a lot of bundling that goes on from sort of high donors. You're right. You'd be trading that for, in effect, bundling or assembling potentially contributions from small donors. So you might have an environmental group that says to their membership, hey, you know, John Sarbanes is good on the environment. We ought to try to collect some small donations for him. So they send out a bulletin to their members and say, we think you ought to contribute $5 or $10 to Sarbanes because he's trying to do the right thing on the environment. And maybe in that way you bring in a fair number of those small donations. What I like, though, is even those are being bundled, no individual gets a louder voice than anybody else because they're all small donations. And I'll trade whatever sort of pressure could come from a small donor universe kind of getting together. I'll trade the pressure that comes from the Goldman Sachs and the Halliburtons of the world for the pressure that comes from everyday citizens and small donors. You know, I'll trade that any day because
they gave you $10.
Yeah, because I think that's more democratic.
What happens now, by the way, under the current system? I think Senator Cardin was in here talking once about how much time he spends on the phone raising money. Other candidates have expressed this. And in very competitive races, your colleagues in the House spend gobs and gobs of hours on the phone, cold calling people for money or calling people who supported them in the past. So that's the system now.
That's the system.
And in fact, you're in recess now. Congress is in recess for a fairly long period here so that incumbents can run for re-election and raise money, right?
A lot of the time being spent during this recess is people on the phones calling large donors and seeking funding. And there's evidence, Dan, to suggest that the average member of Congress spends anywhere from 30 to 70% of their time on fundraising. If you think about it, what's the casualty in that is, first of all, you don't have the time to spend actually reading the material, which is what your constituents rightfully expect you to do.
Like the Patriot Act, for instance.
Yeah, for example. Yeah. But the other thing is you don't have time to build relationships with your colleagues. That is probably the most pernicious effect of this. And so when it comes time to reach compromise on legislation, that trust isn't there because you just don't know each other because so much time is being taken by the fundraising. And, you know, the other thing is money just gums the system up. Bob Dole, back in 1982, when he was the Senate minority leader, Republican minority leader in the Senate, said, in effect, I'm paraphrasing, he said, if we ever get to a point where everyone has a PAC up here on Capitol Hill, we'll never get anything done. Well, everyone's got a PAC on Capitol Hill, and we're not getting anything done. Now, the fact of the matter is that the great majority of people that go to serve in Congress, I think, are there for the right reasons. They want to do the right thing. But they're trapped inside a system that forces them to raise a lot of money. Television costs money. Mail costs money. Polling costs money. And there's only one place to go to get that money right now, and that is the big money donors and the PACs. If we could create another place to go, like a small donor matching system, in a heartbeat, you would see a lot of members who'd say, you know, that's where I want to spend my time. That's how I want to raise my money. And you would begin to shift the attention of individual members and the institution as a whole back to the concerns of everyday citizens.
John Sarbanes, before we go back to the phone lines, does the bill, Government by the People Act, does it set a ceiling or a goal for how much money needs to be raised by small donations before the 6-to-1 match?
In order to qualify, you have to raise $50,000 in small donations from at least 1,000 small donors.
Okay, thank you. Janet in Richmond. Janet, thank you for calling Midday. You're on with John Sarbanes.
Good afternoon. Congressman Sarbanes, I want to tell you I'm really supportive of your small donor matching initiative. I think that's an excellent idea, and I think you're realistic about the possibility of overturning Citizens United. My point was, I think we might also want to look at limiting the cost of campaigns, and one way to do that might be limiting the number of hours of television ads that candidates can buy. What if every candidate only got X number of hours, and that was all they could buy?
Well, I understand where you're coming from on that, and I've heard that a similar kind of proposal from others. The problem is you get yourself right back into trouble with this court's jurisprudence, because then you're limiting speech. They have declared that money is speech, and therefore if you've got enough money to buy extra television time or radio time or mail time, you should be able to exercise that. That's their interpretation of the First Amendment. I don't necessarily agree with where they've taken this, but that's the kind of jurisprudential universe we're living in right now with this Supreme Court. Now, one thing we can do is we can make sure that the broadcast industry, which, by the way, is using a public license, right? I mean, the airways belong to the public, and we then license them to the broadcast industry. So there ought to be certain conditions under which that happens. And there are. For example, television time for legitimate candidates as opposed to super PACs has to be provided at what they call the lease unit, the lowest unit cost charge. But the broadcast industry has found ways to get through that. They've got loopholes. They run your commercials at 4 in the morning if you don't pay a premium, things like this. So actually, my bill includes some provisions that would at least require the broadcast industry to live by the requirements that are currently in place.
But her point, it goes back to that issue you raised about containment, trying to contain free speech, trying to contain campaign contributions. That isn't going to work. Let's try something else, right? Given the trends of the Supreme Court. Let's go to Gino in Fells Point, and then Jeffrey, so hang in there. Go ahead, Gino. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I live in a congressman's district, and watched him from afar. I don't know him personally, but he is, by all accounts, one of the good guys in Congress, and I feel like we're well represented. I would like to bring the conversation back a little bit closer to home. I definitely agree with you in the macro sense that money is corrupting politics and congressional races in this country, but in Maryland, I also feel that gerrymandering is doing it. You know, our district is drawn, I think it's one of the third or fourth least connected districts in the country, and I'd like your comments on how that factors into limiting, you know, fair and balanced representation. And I don't think we ever see a serious primary challenge to any of Maryland's 8 candidates. We did have one, Bartlett was knocked off, but the congressional districts in and around Baltimore seem like they're locked down, not only from Republicans, but from inter-party competition.
There's no question that the shape of the districts in Maryland when most people look at them, they kind of scratch their heads. And it kind of adds to the cynicism that I mentioned out there. There's a lot of sources of cynicism, and gerrymandering is one of them. I support reform in Congress, and there's a bill that will, I think, be introduced soon that would set standards for how you could appoint independent commissions across the country
to draw the lines.
Which I think would address some of the cynicism that people have. I do want to, though, in terms of this connection to money, point out that the more competitive a district is, and I think they should be competitive. I certainly don't resist that. But the more competitive they are, the more money you're going to need to run the races, the more money you're going to have to raise, and the more potentially you're going to have to go to these big sources of money. So their influence potentially gets even greater. All the more reason why we need to have another place for candidates to go raise money.
Let me go back to what you were describing before. I asked you about that goal that had to be reached, $50,000.
Yes.
Okay, so that's a lot of money. But, you know, if you know 10 friends and they know 10 friends and they know 10 friends, you go back to that old system of raising that. If I raised $50,000, I wanted to go run for Congress against you.
Yeah.
I raised $50,000.
From 1,000 donors.
From 1,000 donors.
At least.
I would get another $300,000?
Correct. You're in your game. You can compete. And that's the other thing. For people who feel like incumbents have gotten too comfortable, if you're not an incumbent who's going to reach out and develop that small donor network and connect with your constituents, you will be vulnerable to a challenger that goes out and starts knocking on doors and collecting those small donations. And that's how it should be.
If I was going to run against you, I would think I'm running against your name, Sarbanes, pretty well-established congressman. How many terms have you had now?
Four terms.
It'd be a fourth term. And then I would think, well, how am I going to raise, what would it take to beat you? A couple million dollars, right?
Right, but this is another good point. If you look in places where you've had public financing of campaigns, Connecticut, New York City, Maine, not only is it empowering everyday citizens, it's also making much more viable candidates who in the past would never have stepped in because they couldn't get through what they call the money primary because they don't know a lot of people who have a lot of money. But in those places, you're seeing more minority candidates, more women candidates, more socioeconomic diversity in the candidate pool. In Connecticut, after they put public financing in, women candidates who ran and were successful increased by 30%. I sat on a panel with a woman named Diane Russell who's in the Maine legislature, doesn't know a lot of money people, ran on public financing, got in and competed. She said, I'm a cashier. I've been working in a supermarket for 15 years. I know hundreds of people, not a lot of people with money, but when I was able to raise small donations, earn public funds, I was competitive and I won. That's the promise of this kind of a system.
Hey, Jeffrey is holding here to make a comment. Jeffrey, we're short of time, but go right ahead, please.
Okay, hi. Good afternoon. As I was saying, I think this idea is pretty idealistic, but what you've got to overcome is, a politician really wanting to make that change and then feeling that they can make the change without exposing themselves. Because you're going to a small donor model, you're still going to have the big money just throwing millions and millions of dollars into the campaign of their opponents. So I don't think that individual is going to want to take the first step.
Yeah,
and
well,
then on top
Jeffrey,
of that, Jeffrey,
I'm sorry. So the question is, how do you convince Congress?
So that's a great place to end.
He's got a great point there.
Because
how do you convince your colleagues to do this?
It's a great place to end because people say, oh, this is pie in the sky. It sounds great, but it'll never happen. You'll never get the members to actually participate. I think this is doable. And when I've talked to my colleagues, and the fact that we have almost 160 who've co-sponsored it, we ran a model and we showed my colleagues, based on their 2012 profile, you step into this system, you can raise as much, if not more, with this new publicly funded system as you do now. Hmm. That's the viability that'll make this thing work.
So money talks, even in your system.
Yeah.
Well, Jeffrey, I hope we answered your question. If you want to follow up, send us an email. Will anybody out there in the audience have further questions about this? It's House Resolution 20?
Yeah, it's Government by the People Act, H.R. 20. And if you want to learn more about what we're doing in the 3rd District, go to myvoicedoescount.com. Or you can go to 313131, text that number, and put in the word voice, and you'll get all the information you need.
John Sarbanes, incumbent congressman from the 3rd District of Maryland. Thank you very much for being here, John.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Stay tuned for the news, and then we'll have the second hour of Midday.